from WVUR Boston and NPR. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 75 authors and artists, from Philip Roth to Gillian Flynn to Robert Caro, revisited a first edition of one of their works. They made notes in the margins, drew pictures, wrote down memories, all by hand. These one-of-a-kind literary treasures will go up for auction tomorrow at Christie's in New York to support the Pen American Center's push for artistic and journalistic freedom. Three of those Pulitzer Prize-winning authors are with us today. Jane Smiley, Juno Diaz, Rita Dove. This hour on Point, what happens when artists revisit and reconsider an old masterpiece? You can join us on air or online. What's your question on the creative process for our writers? Are you curious to see and read in the author's own script what inspired them? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Suzanne Nossel, Executive Director of the Pen American Center. She helped organize tomorrow's auction of the 75 first edition books. Suzanne Nossel, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So what a wonderful idea to ask a writer to revisit a classic work. Where did this idea come from?
Well, we stole it from English Pen. They did an auction like this 18 months ago in London, and the project was cooked up by an editor there. And I think when they started, they really didn't know what they had on their hands. They were sort of reaching out to Pen members and different writers. And as the books started coming in, they began to realize these were really treasures. So what was originally conceived to be perhaps an auction in the lobby of the building where English Pen has their offices kind of evolved into a major event. And thankfully, they confined themselves to British writers and writers from the Commonwealth. They didn't ask any American writers to participate. They left that to us, their sister organization, Pen American Center. So that's what we're doing tomorrow.
Good thing. 75 writers participated here in the United States. What exactly did you ask them to do?
We asked them to take a first edition of generally their most important and beloved book and go through and annotate it in longhand. And so what does annotation mean? It really meant many different things to each individual writer. They wrote notes, anecdotes, reminiscences, made edits. Some of them drew pictures, doodles, illustrations that were never there in the original. So this sort of took on a flight of fancy with each individual writer. So every book is totally unique, and they really poured heart and soul into the project.
Did anybody want to make major edits to their important and beloved work?
Well, there were some second thoughts, true second thoughts. We call it second thoughts on first editions. And there definitely were writers who regretted a sentence. Catherine Patterson, the first sentence of Bridge to Terabithia, you know, says this sentence has been reviled, and she has her own misgivings about it. And there are plenty of other writers who did say if they had the chance to do it over, they might have done it a little bit differently.
These annotated treasures, as you call them, and they are going up for auction at Christie's tomorrow. Tell us about Pen American and this mission that you have, that you're raising money for to support writers and artists around the world.
Well, we're really the only organization that both celebrates and defends freedom of expression. We have a case list of over 900 writers all over the world who are jailed, persecuted, threatened for what they write and for the expression of their views. And increasingly in the digital age, these are writers who are getting into hot water, not just for a book or an editorial, but sometimes for a Facebook post or a tweet. So we are under pressure to defend more writers in more places who are sticking their heads above the parapet and taking the risk of expressing themselves in places like China or Russia or Turkey, where it really can be dangerous.
Do you have a favorite memory or illustration or anecdote from these classic annotated works?
Well, there's so many that stay with you. I mean, if you look at Orhan Pamuk's book Snow, he draws and uses watercolor to illustrate this manuscript and kind of set the scene of this remote town on the Armenian border. And it's just so evocative. It's sort of the picture in your mind suddenly comes to life, and you feel like you and the author kind of share that mental image of exactly what it must have been like.
Suzanne, hold on for just a moment. We're going to bring in now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Juno Diaz. He won the Pulitzer Prize for The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, which he annotated for this auction. He's a professor of creative writing at MIT and the fiction editor at Boston Review. His most recent book, This Is How You Lose Her, is a collection of short stories. Juno Diaz, welcome back to On Point.
Jane, thank you for having me back.
So nice to have you. What were your initial thoughts about revisiting your work for this project, Juno?
Well, I mean, to be completely honest, it's still rather recent. I think maybe after 20 years, it would have been less fraught. But I'm still at the stage that when I look at the book, what I see mostly is the scaffolding. I can't enter the book the way a reader does. So I definitely was a bit reluctant, but the cause was so stupendously important that I just kind of dove in.
You've said that a book is in part a memory of other books. And what I've tried to accomplish in this annotation is to recover the secret traces of that memory. So what did you recover?
My God, what I recovered was basically hundreds of hours of reading that feeds every line you write. And it was a kind of an extraordinary kind of shadow infrastructure, this shadow sort of network of books that makes the book you're writing possible. And, you know, there were authors who I hadn't thought in about a few years. Folks like Zora Neale Hurston, which one would think you should always have on your mind. But I was reading her obsessively while I was writing this novel, and when I was doing these annotations, I kept thinking, "My God, I was reading quite a lot while I was writing this."
Did you want to change anything dramatically as you read it again?
Oh God, yeah, of course. I mean, there, in some ways, there wasn't enough time and enough pages to point out the ways that I felt that I might improve on the effort. But you know, in the end, these things, they're all about, they're all about making concessions. There's no book where you don't make concessions. And I think a part of me kind of accepted the fact that I did as best as I could, given what I had.
Your notes included information about what sections of the book you wrote first. You sort of put it in order. Do you think that leads readers to a better understanding of the novel, of your Pulitzer Prize winning work?
God, I don't know. I mean, I always think that there's some, it depends on the folks, right? Like some folks don't want to know anything more than the book itself. Others like to, look under the hood and see what was going on there. I think when it comes down to it, some scholars and some readers might find it interesting. But really, ultimately, if you're a nerdy reader like I am, the book has primacy. The book sort of has the final vote.
In your annotations, we learn that in earlier drafts, the title was different. It was called Kilometer Zero. I'm curious why the change.
Because that sounds like a really bad book in some ways. Not like the final title was any better. It seemed way too technical and, it did. If someone kept pointing it out, they're like, is this an atlas? I was like, oh, man, I gotta get rid of that,
I'm curious, did the experience affect how or what you write now? Would you change your approach to writing after doing this particular project?
I think, again, I've been at it for a couple of decades as being a writer, and one wishes they were more nimble. I mean, I myself wish I learned faster than I do, but sometimes I feel like my approach to writing is like this massive ocean liner. It's like the Titanic. It does not turn on a dime. Certainly learned a whole bunch of things that I would love to integrate, but how quickly that would happen, that's up for grabs. I think only the pages will tell.
Juno Diaz, joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts today, author of The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He annotated his first edition work for this auction. Thank you so much, Juno. Nice to have you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much.
Suzanne Nussel, were there any authors that rejected your request to
relook
and revisit a classic work?
There were. I mean, it was tough going with some of the writers. I think writers have a natural reluctance to delve into past work. It can bring up old demons. It can remind them of things that they wish they had done differently. Sometimes it's kind of going back to a triumphant moment in their career that feels like a long time ago. So it can be painful in a lot of ways. And I would say many of the writers had some hesitation, but like Juno Diaz, they sort of overcame it because of the worthiness of the cause. Writers are very, very passionate about Penn and our mission and the idea of helping other writers around the world. But for some, it was just a bridge too far to ask them to go back and delve in. So there definitely were some who turned us down.
There was some hesitation, too. Robert Caro started writing The Power Broker when he was 29. He worked on it for 7 years. He hadn't opened it, hadn't cracked the book in 40 years. Is that right?
Yeah, that was sort of one of the most moving stories of this, that he delved into it after 4 long decades and also 40 years of further transformation in the life of the city of New York, which he documents in The Power Broker, the story of Robert Moses, who was kind of the father and the architect of the modern city in so many ways. And for him, it was, I think, transformative, going back to a different era of his life, the beginning of this storied career. It was really The Power Broker that kind of put him on the map. And I think he put the word power broker on the map with that book. It's now become a term that we hear about all the time in politics and the corporate world. And I think before Robert Caro's account of Robert Moses, it wasn't.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about authors revisiting one of their famous published works, and you can join the conversation. When you read your own writing, even a journal, what do you see in your younger self? How have you changed? We're speaking with Suzanne Nossel this hour, executive director of the Penn American Center. She helped organize tomorrow's auction of 75 annotated first edition books. Suzanne, give us a feeling for who these authors are.
Well, it's everybody from Woody Allen to Stephen Sondheim to Don DeLillo, Paul Auster, Toni Morrison, and then 15 artists, Marina Abramović, Richard Serra, Alex Soth. It's just an extraordinary collection of really some of the greatest living American literary and artistic figures, kind of all packaged into one project. It's amazing to see their work displayed alongside one another's.
So many of these books are so iconic. It's almost like the words in the books don't belong to the writers anymore. Did you get that sense? Did many of them speak that to you?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what makes it so fascinating, because these have become cultural icons. We think we understand them. We think we own them as a society. And in reading the annotations, you kind of get the almost a portal into the mind of the writer, and at a couple of different levels. I mean, one is what was going on in their lives when they wrote this. In many cases, they talk about, you know, Tony Kushner talking about the death of his mother in the middle of writing Angels in America between two of the volumes, and kind of how that affected him and sort of set him back and kind of reset the project. But then also the act of looking back after so many years at something that in many cases kind of made their career take off. So they weren't who they are today until, you know, in the case of Richard Ford, for example, you know, until he wrote his book, he was a struggling writer. And then The Sports Writer came out and he became Richard Ford.
Mm. Let me bring in another author here from Carmel Valley, California's Jane Smiley. She annotated her 1991 novel, A Thousand Acres, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Her most recent novel is Some Luck, out earlier this year. She is a professor of creative writing at the University of California at Riverside. Jane Smiley, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. So some authors say this process was a process of self-discovery. Others say it was a painful reminder of a difficult journey when they were younger. What was it like for you?
I just thought it was interesting, and I think I related to the book as a book, not as an experience, actually.
In what way?
Well, I hadn't read it since then. So a lot of the things that I remembered about it, I had forgotten truly a lot about it. So when I started rereading it again, I read it more as just a novel that I was reading, and I actually enjoyed it.
You did. You actually enjoyed it.
Yeah, so I didn't relate to it as it reminding me of experiences that I was having at the time. I related it more as to it more as images of a place where I once lived and that I thought about. It was quite interesting in that way to me.
Hmm. I read that you hadn't cracked open 1,000 acres in 20 years. Is that right?
Well, at least, yeah.
At least. And you said this process was like, quote, welcoming home the last child, seeing where you went wrong and where you went right. Tell me more about that. And would you have changed anything, Jane Smiley?
Well, I did find a typo. So I guess the copy editor and I didn't quite do our jobs.
You found a typo in the first edition?
Yeah. But I don't know that I would have changed anything. I think that's what I'm getting at when I say I read it as if it were a novel. It just is, you know? Mm. And so it seemed sort of like just a thing to me that was not a process. And so I responded to it, and when I came to various parts in the novel that are sad or tragic, I said, oh, whoa, but I responded to it as a reader rather than its writer.
Hmm. You included a note, Jane, on the title page explaining the moment of inspiration for this novel, On the Road, where the whole thing came together. Tell us what happened and what you wrote in the book about that.
Well, I had been pondering King Lear for years, all through college and graduate school, and I'd spent years thinking I wanted to rewrite it from the point of view of the daughters. And so one day... I was living in Ames, Iowa at the time, and I had young children, and we were driving from Minneapolis, where we used to go for a little bit of fun. And it was probably March, I think it was March, and the weather was very gloomy, and we were driving down Highway 35 from Minneapolis to Ames. And that part of Iowa is quite interesting. It's very flat, and it's known as the Pothole Prairie. And so it was quite gloomy and cloudy and rainy, and I was just sitting in the car, and I looked around, and I said to my husband, oh, I should set that King Lear book here. And as soon as I had that thought, bingo, it all came to me. Hmm. And so I got home, and I immediately went, and I had read some things about the Pothole Prairie, but I immediately went to the library and looked up more stuff. And the interesting thing about it, I had read an article sometime around that period, I think, about chemical fertilizers and other chemicals in the land and how they would, in that particular area, because there was so much water in the land, they would get it to the aquifer, and then they would come up in the wells. And so there was a rise in the incidence of cancer in that, just because of the way that the aquifer was built there. Hmm. And so I looked that up, and I thought, oh, this is perfect. You know, this is exactly where I want to set it. Hmm. And my new book, which is also set in Iowa, is set farther to the south and east of that. It's not set in the Pothole Prairie. It's set in more rolling country. So that was one of the things that, since I've been working on the new books, and then I did that simultaneously with redoing the pen edition, it was very apparent in my mind that these were two different landscapes. Hmm. Both physically and psychologically to me.
Let me get a caller in here from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, John. Welcome to On Point.
I'm interested in what has been said about the difference between the author and the work itself. know, there are many good examples of how terrible a person Ezra Pound was and how great the poetry is. Writers on their own work, I'm putting this to the project people, aren't they acting more like another editor or like an author?
Hmm. John, thank you. Suzanne Nassel, would you respond to the caller?
Well, we really asked them to act like an author and to kind of approach this with a lot of creative freedom. And so some people did go back and almost kind of edit their work and say, you know, Malcolm Gladwell saying this was the worst chapter, it was too long, I'm sorry about that. But others really just ruminating about kind of the atmospherics when they wrote the book. Some writers inserted into the book, Michael Cunningham, when he was writing The Hours, had different postcards that were posted in his office where he wrote. And he also inserted into the annotated edition a CD of the music that he listened to when he was writing the book. So to give the reader the full atmosphere of kind of what this experience was like, so that you can kind of transport yourself and almost become Michael Cunningham. So when it goes up for auction tomorrow, people can take a look at all of this richness, and some lucky individuals will get to own it and treasure it. And it really is an absolutely unique and almost a new creation. It's a new work of art that they have put together that is available, you know, just this one time.
Here's Bob in Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a question for Suzanne. With the auction that's coming up, does the purchaser get the exclusive access to the author's notes, or are they going to be made public in some way for students and the general interest?
Well, it is exclusive, at least for a long period of time. And in terms of the physical copy, it's completely exclusive to the purchaser.
Bob, thank you. Let's go back to Jane Smiley for a moment. Jane, what surprised you most about this process?
Well, I suppose for me the oddest thing was how difficult it is to write because I don't write by hand anymore. Mm. And so scribbling the notes was, I went back to being 10 years old and thinking that my handwriting wasn't good enough, you know. How is anybody going to read this? So that was the surprise to me, that it was physically difficult to do. Another thing that surprised me was how brilliantly lit the imagery from the novel was. You know, I would read pages and I would see things that I hadn't thought about in, you know, 30 years, and I would, or 25 years, and it would be very vivid in my mind, the images that I was reading about. I thought that was a good thing. I like that.
Here's Jordan in New Milford, Connecticut. Hi, Jordan. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that several years ago when I first started high school, I had gotten to work on my very first book. It was a super ambitious project, and it took me some years to finish making it. And I really loved the story, the characters, the plot, but unfortunately, it really needs a lot of work. And so I took a couple years off after I wrote that book, and I actually got to work on what would become my first published book, Me Squared. It's a story of a boy who his parents clone him. And I now, just last month, I started revisiting my very first book, the super ambitious one.
And what did you see looking back all those years, Jordan?
Well, I can definitely see a lot of how I've improved as a writer. And also what changes I need to make. But again, I can also see where my ambition had led me to good places. So I'm happy that I did take a couple years off to work on something else. And now I feel like I have the experience to go forth and edit this book and make it something a lot better.
Jordan, thank you. Jane Smiley, how was it to look back at your younger self, your younger author self, during this work?
Well, oddly enough, and this is just by chance, I did read a couple of other books that I had written just before I wrote A Thousand Acres. And my younger self was a lot darker than my current self. And I don't know exactly why that is. Maybe that's just natural to being in your 30s. So that struck me, that my current self is a lot more optimistic and more attuned maybe to comedy than to tragedy.
As you mentioned, A Thousand Acres is a rough retelling of King Lear. And I'm curious, did you revisit Shakespeare then again, too, as you were revisiting and reworking your first draft of this wonderful book?
I did not.
Suzanne Nussel, tell us about some of the other works that you've been reviewing for your auction tomorrow.
Well, we've got Portnoy's Complaint, Philip Roth's epic and monumental novel, and he sort of goes back to it and expresses a lot of pride in this incredibly daring, reckless, as he calls it, younger self that was so exuberant and, you know, so forceful, so uninhibited, and published this book that really, you know, rocked and shocked everybody right up to Richard Nixon at the White House. And so seeing him now in his 80s kind of going back to this moment and feeling, you know, great pride at what he, the boundaries that he broke as a younger man, it's quite extraordinary. You know, Kiki Smith, one of the artists who contributed, created the most exquisite. It's almost like a book that transforms into a bird. It has wings with a 7-foot span that unfurl and are intricately drawn and colored with this kind of feathery drawing of a supernatural being that looks like it's part human and part bird, and the whole thing kind of folds up into the pages of the book but then unfurls to be the most extraordinary work of art. It's something, you know, I don't think anybody but her would have ever imagined doing, you know, if they were asked for an annotation. It's certainly not something we ever imagined getting back, but it is just an extraordinarily beautiful work of art. Mm.
Tell us about Toni Morrison's annotations from Beloved.
Well, she was not one of the most extensive annotations in the collection, but she does, you know, sort of take a moment to reflect on this book and kind of what it meant to her at the time. And she writes kind of briefly but quite beautifully.
And Yoko Ono?
You know, she too, you know, it's kind of this exuberant, you know, with her handwriting, you know, and remembering John. So it's you know, you sense how this work, Acorn, kind of connects to her whole life experience.
And Richard Serra was another one that was a popular.
Richard Serra, you know, very, you know, kind of artistic and broad brush, you know, not a detailed revisiting, but more kind of an artistic reimagining of his book.
Well, Jane Smiley has been with us this hour, author of A Thousand Acres, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, which she annotated for this auction. Her most recent novel is called Some Luck. She's a professor now of creative writing at the University of California at Riverside. Jane Smiley, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning authors revisiting their famous published works this hour, and you can join the conversation. Is there something wonderful or something terrifying about going back and remembering who you were as a writer or as a person? We're speaking with this hour with Suzanne Nussel, executive director of the Penn American Center. She helped organize tomorrow's auction of 75 annotated first edition books. Back to the phones. Maggie is in Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Maggie. Maggie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I find this whole conversation so fascinating, and I'm so glad you're asking the questions you're asking. I am, I've loved everything everyone has said, and I am having to republish. I'm actually relaunching a book. It's in a new expanded edition. So I've had, and it's been over the past 2 years. So listening to all these experiences of people, authors revisiting their work, you know, 20 years later or 15 years or whatever, and going back and looking at that whole process, I've had to do that in like a year and a half. And it's the funny thing that I've found is that I have the same experience.
Interesting.
It's just as almost foreign and exploratory in only that short amount of time for me. And I guess the only thing I really wanted to say is I think there's something that's not a matter of necessarily time passing. So obviously I'm not that much more mature than I was really temporally speaking.
Yeah.
Than 2 years ago. But there's something about the process of completing a book that I think matures one.
Mm. Well, that's interesting.
You know, and that's an interesting thing that I don't think is really relative to time. And it just this conversation kind of made me have that thought. So I just thought I'd share that.
Maggie, thank you. Thank you very much. Suzanne Nussel, would you respond?
Well, I think it's true. When people have to kind of close the book and send in the final manuscript and kind of close the chapter on this work that has been so immersive. And, you know, for a novelist, it's a world that they have inhabited. And so in a sense, years later, when they revisit, they travel back in time to inhabit that world and visit those characters again, as a different person. And what's interesting is they experience it very differently. I mean, some people saying that they still look at all the scaffolding and all they can see is sort of the process and the agony of getting their book out, whereas others have the distance where they can appreciate their novel as a reader would and get immersed in the story almost as if the book were written by somebody else.
Hmm. Here's a comment from our website. Gerald says, I'd be interested in knowing if there were any authors who came back to an early book that they'd been forced to alter due to what at the time they considered heavy-handed editorial interference, but which, on reflection, was actually improved by the editor's heavy hand. Suzanne Nussel, do you know?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure we have examples of that, but we do have a number of writers who talk about how they fiercely fought back editors who wanted to make changes, and they defended their own text, and they're kind of glad to do so. I'm not sure anybody took the opportunity to say, you know, I would have made a mistake, but somebody corrected it for me or made my manuscript better.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now from Akron, Ohio, Rita Dove. She's the former Poet Laureate of the United States and won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1987. For this auction, she annotated her book, 10 Poems by Rita Dove, from 1977. Her most recent poetry collection is Sonata Mulataka. She is a professor of English at the University of Virginia. Rita Dove, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here. Hi, Jane.
Well, how did you respond to this request to revisit your work so many years later?
Well, I think I responded the way many authors may have responded, which was at first with, it's a kind of delightful horror. you know, you say, oh my gosh, I haven't looked at that in years. And then the idea of annotating something to actually write on the page is a really, really terrifying prospect.
Hmm. You wrote, I felt like a graffiti artist defacing a public building. After the first few ink strokes, the most astonishing thing happened. I was in a conversation with my younger self, end quote. So you were 24 or 25, I believe, when 10 Poems by Rita Dove was published?
Yes, that's right.
What did rereading it tell you about your younger self?
Wow. Well, first of all, it was my very first book, and and not only is it the first book, but it's an art book. It's a chapbook that's done hand lettered and, you know, hand set. And so it was really like defacing something pristine. The copies that I had myself, I would handle with gloves on because they were so beautiful and fragile. So it was not only defacing, it was defacing the artwork that was done by the printer, Bonnie O'Connell. But then revisiting the poems after a few strokes, and it was really horrible to write on it, but after a few strokes, I began to look at the poems and realize how young I was, how fearless youth is, and to talk to this person who had written these poems as if it wasn't myself. It was a kind of a an amazing journey.
Mm. You said, I can't believe how terrifying it is to deface a work of art like this, whose siblings I have been protecting for 37 years. There, I've done it. Rita Dove, what did you mean by that? Whose siblings I've been protecting for 37 years?
The siblings, it's a two-faced thing, actually. The siblings were the other copies of the book. There were only 200 made, and I think I have only two copies myself. And I have protected them from light and heat and all sorts of things and tried to keep them pristine as objects because it was a hand-lettered book. But the other siblings, it's the idea that I think my whole life I've kind of sworn that as a poet, I really didn't want to go back and revisit work, but I wanted to keep going forward. In other words, I wasn't going to go back and reprint poems and change them dramatically because the person that I was at the moment when I composed the poem was a very, very different person than I am today. Mm. I think that with poets particularly, your interface with the world is a very thin screen indeed. And so the soul of who you are at that moment really does imprint on the work itself. Mm. And to try to change a poem years later with after, you know, lots of experience or whatever it is, changes actually the whole emotional core and reverberation of the work.
Some of your annotations, Rita, are as lengthy as the 15-line poems that you write about. You made annotations, I think, on every one of the 10 poems in your book. Were you surprised by how much you still wanted to say, still how much you had to say?
Actually, I was surprised, Jane, because I thought at first, oh, this is going to be, this, you know, I won't have much to say because poems, of course, try to use as few words as possible to say as much as possible. So why would I want to clutter that up with words? And yet, when I did begin to get into this conversation with myself, so to speak, my younger self, it basically was almost like looking at one of my students' work in a creative writing class and saying, no, not that. Oh, please. Oh, wow. Or that's pretty good. And then I'd look at it and go, oh, my gosh, did I really, you know, talk about it like that. But it was refreshing, too, to go back to them and to see, to recognize, actually, things that stuck with me, you know, kind of themes that stuck with me, forgotten heroes, you know, times which have been erased, and to realize, oh, my gosh, even then when I was so young and had maybe half a dozen poems published in literary magazines or so, you know, that even then there were passions that never left me.
Here's Anne in Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Anne. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane. That's a fascinating discussion. I keep thinking back, though, to Andre Gide's warning that we expend a lot of time and energy trying to recapture the wonderful moments that of our youth. Mm. And I wonder how that impacts on some of your people there.
Mm. Anne, thank you. Suzanne Nussel?
Well, I think there almost was not a spirit of regret in most of these books. I mean, where people were looking back after many years, as Rita Dove says, they tended to be quite pleased with what they found and to sort of treasure the exuberance and the creativity of their younger self. If in some cases, you know, Michael Chabon comes up as an example, you know, saying there was a bit of hubris there, maybe. But I didn't sense, you know, a kind of longing or fixation with the past. And I think it is worth also noting, you know, I think it's a good point that Rita Dove has made that first editions are, they have inherent value. They're considered pristine. They're kept very carefully with a dust jacket and out of the light. And here we've asked people to kind of run riot over that and to go through with a marking pen. Some use highlighter pens. Some use different color pens. George Saunders is probably one of those colorful books in the collection on offer. And to sort of rewrite history a little bit, in a sense. And so it's kind of really empowering the person who they are today to create a new work of art out of something that they began with, in some cases, many, many years ago.
And for some authors, it was a chance to explain what they meant in the process. As far as, here's Gillian Flynn saying, some people hated my ending, some people loved it, but many people didn't. And so it was an opportunity for her to say, well, this is why I did what I did, Suzanne.
Yeah, that's right. To answer kind of the unanswered questions, in some cases answer the critics, and give a little bit of spin and insight. And that's one of the reasons why these books are of great scholarly interest as well, because if you look at something like the annotation of Don DeLillo's Underworld, which is so extensive over every single page, you'll never get as thorough a set of comments and treasured and invaluable commentary on understanding that work of art and its place in American literature as you will find in these annotations. So they have interest to readers, they have interest to scholars, they have interest to book collectors, and kind of all of that comes together in sort of what's going to be a real moment in American literary history.
Rita Dove, your work covers such a wide variety of historical and political events. I'm curious, has history changed the way you view your poetry?
That's a wonderful question, actually. It does in a certain way, because I think that what happened to me is that after I got the Pulitzer, and I think for many authors it was like this, as soon as it should become recognized on a larger scale, things happen, doors slam shut behind you, and one tends to exist for the public only at that moment forward. And to go back and revisit poems that happened before the big prizes and stuff like that, and to connect with that younger self is actually a very sobering moment and a wonderful thing. And I realized that the public eye has changed in a certain way how I write a poem. So yeah, it has changed a bit, and I think that is very useful, as Suzanne says, for both scholars and even younger writers. Anyone who's trying to do something, realize that when you first start out, you have no idea where you're going to end up. To see someone reflect on that reminds you that you can keep moving forward.
You were the youngest person, Rita Dove, to be named Poet Laureate of the United States when you assumed that post in 1993. I'm just curious, what was that like for you?
As a poet, poets are often very, I think, introspective and less likely to want to kind of be out there in the public. It was a learning curve, let's put it that way. And yet I felt so firmly that poetry had been pushed to the sidelines in the United States, and that many people were afraid of poetry, unnecessarily so. And so I thought this was my opportunity to be there and to try to bring poetry into the world. So it was a mission, in a sense, and that helped me get over that sense of introspection and shyness, and to say, it's not about me, it's not about how I feel, it's really about the thing that I love and what I can do for poetry.
I'm curious, Rita, finally here, if annotating one of your original works affected how or what you write now. Would you change your approach to writing after doing this?
I would not change my approach to writing, but I must say that because I'm a slightly different poet now than I was then, I don't write exactly the way I wrote then. Yet, when I went back to this and annotated this, I was struck by a really fresh wave of wanting to write. In other words, I felt, now I can. I think it helped recapture some of the wonder, and that's one of the things about first editions that is precious and can't be repeated. Mm-hmm. It's just that sense of wonder as you write, as the work opening up. And going back to that book, I thought, there it is. And I got a little whiff of fresh air again. Mm. So it started me writing full force.
Suzanne Nossel, finishes up here and tell us how the auction tomorrow at Christie's will impact authors and artists around the world.
Well, At Pan American Center, our work is focused on helping writers who are under threat and who are really at the front lines of the battle for free expression wherever it's taking place, whether that's in China or in Ferguson, Missouri, where we've documented infringements on press freedom for journalists who've been covering the protests, and we've documented infringements on press freedom for writers combating surveillance. So this will help infuse all of our work with new resources and new energy and, just as Rita Dove says, new inspiration.
Suzanne Nossel, Executive Director of the Pan American Center. She helped organize tomorrow's auction of 75 annotated first edition books. Good luck tomorrow, Suzanne. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jane.
Rita Dove, former Poet Laureate, Pulitzer Prize winner. Really great to have you, Rita. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.